Parataya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Grantitam Purana Muninam Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santadami Bhagavad Gita Bhagavadvaishini. One verse 29. Samoham sarvabhuteshu, samoham sarvabhuteshu, name dveshosti na priyaha, name dveshosti na priyaha, ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya, ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya, mayite teshu chapyaham. Mayite teshu chapyaham. Do they have the right place? Okay.
Yeah.
Samaha aham sarvabhuteshu na me dveshaha asti na priyaha ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya mayite teshu cha api aham. In these previous verses, you know, especially this verse 27, Bhagavan says, Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, whatever you do, whatever action you do, whatever food you eat, whatever rituals you do, whatever things that you give as charity, whatever austerities you do, may you do those as a worship of me. Madarpanam, keeping me in mind. That really means is that karma yoga buddhi, may all of your actions, you know, and all the ways that you relate to the world really be a puja, be done for my sake, keeping me in view. So there's been a lot of verses like that, and then he says in the next verse, you know, in this manner, keeping me in view, having this karma yoga buddhi. This buddhi, the karma, buddhi means that conviction or that state of mind that really views the whole creation as Ishwara. That's basically, just to do a little bit of karma yoga here, just to make this clear. A karma yoga buddhi means one has a certain attitude toward the actions that one does in the life. And basically, it has to do with, the karma yoga buddhi means I see all of this whole creation as Ishwara. And I see the results of all of my actions as, take all the results of all of my actions as prasad, with a prasada buddhi. Means I take them as an offering from Ishwara. So I don't take them as random acts. I take them as something which is actually given to me from Ishwara with that prasada buddhi. Whereas like in a temple after a ritual is done, then the pujari will offer you some prasad from the Lord. And how do you receive that prasad? You receive it with a sense of awe and wonder and gratitude and with a certain humility. And so in that way, we look at the whole creation, you know, and all the results of our actions as being a gift or a prasad from Ishwara. And so with that, when one has that attitude, then my relationship with the whole world really becomes my relationship with Ishwara. So another way to understand that is to look at Ishwara, look at the whole manifest creation, in terms of dharma. In other words, the way I relate to the world or the way I relate to Ishwara is through the following of dharma, that I do what should be done, do in any given situation what is to be done, you know, and I do it with a certain recognition of Ishwara. So I follow Dharma. Why do I follow Dharma? Because the whole creation, the whole expression of the creation, you know, is viewed as Dharma. In other words, whatever I do in the creation that, let me put it this way, how to understand Dharma. We talked about this last week. If I put on the top, as my top value, as the top Dharma, as ahimsa, which is means non-injury. Below that, if I put the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done to yourself, don't do it to others as you wouldn't have done to yourself. That's what we call these two, ahimsa with this golden rule. That's what we call the sadhana dharma. This is the general dharma that every human being needs to learn to follow. Because when it's not followed, there's pain, there's papa, there's dukkha. And so when we follow this ahimsa and golden rule, and then it becomes much more specific, you find yourself in harmony with the creation. That's the thing. It's not that when you're not following Dharma, you're not in harmony with the creation. It's just productive of pain. You're still existing within the creation. You're still following the laws of the creation, but you're butting up against the walls of your own karma. And sometimes those walls are kind of hard. You know, it's like if you're driving a car on these bumper cars, you know, some points you'll bump hard against another car and it's painful for you. And so...
Is she wet?
Yeah, you have to dry her off. She's all soaked. And so you have a towel in there. Please can be dry.
So, not shy.
She got caught. Okay, so let me not get too far into this, but let me sit here just a second. What I was trying to say is, when we say dharma, the other side of dharma is adharma. In other words, if such a thing as dharma exists, and we say, you know, follow dharma or worship the Lord in the form of dharma, you know, that means that adharma exists. So the question is adharma outside of the dharma? No, it's not outside of the dharma. It's just that the results of a dharma, where you're not going, following this kind of the basic harmony of the creation, which has to do with ahimsa, with non-injury, and treating others as you would treat yourself, once you go outside of that, then the laws of the creation, you know, push you back into line. And they push you back into line by the experience of dukkha, really. Papa karmas and the experience of dukkha. And so we could say that in this creation, the experience of sukha and dukkha, of pleasure and pain, in a sense, are great teachers, you know? When you're experiencing pleasure or the sense of all is well with me, you know, then actually that's a natural state. Kind of like the state of the body when the body is healthy. It's a natural state. Your attention isn't drawn to it, you know? Whereas when the body is sick, your attention is drawn to it. When you're off base in your behavior toward others or toward yourself, in fact, you know, all kinds of signals go up. And the signals are in the form of discomfort or in the form of pain. And so that's why I will say that in this life, for somebody who is a mumukshu or who really wants to understand, who wants to know, who wants to understand Ishwara, who wants to understand the truth of the whole thing, of the whole reality that we find ourselves in, that, you know, what is the truth of this whole thing, this whole experience that we have here becomes a sadhana for one who's a seeker, for one who wants moksha, for one who's seeking to know the Lord, to know Ishwara. your entire experience becomes a sadhana. In a sense, we know this anyway, even without having to tell, even having to say anything about this. The creation is a sadhana for us, just unconsciously. Like, for instance, if I put my hand in fire and I get burnt, right? I've learned something, right? I've learned not to do that, right? If I say a harsh word to somebody, I learn not to do that because of what I get back, you know? Any cruel act, eventually I learn that this behavior creates this type of a result. This behavior creates sorrow. This behavior creates happiness. So then you'll find, you know, all of the golden rules, and if you go through all of, like, the, whether it be, you know, the Sankhya, the yoga, the Buddhist, the, whether it's in Christianity and Judaism and Vedanta, there's a list of values that human beings have learned over, you know, over the millennia. And if you were to, and they teach these values, you should do this, this, and this, and don't do this, this, and this. You know? Don't do this. Don't do this. Believe me, I know. That's the idea, though. Believe me, I know. We're passing this on. We're passing these rules on because they don't work. If you do these things, it will create pain. If you do these things, then you're safe. You'll be all right. We tend to take it like, at least in the West, with like the Ten Commandments, they're just a list of rules. You know, that's why I always ask people to read Swamiji's Value of Values, because what he does is go through all of these rules, all of the dharmas that are taught in every culture, and say, why? You know, why has this rule been passed down generation to generation to generation? It's been passed down because of as human beings, we discover, just innately discover dharma in terms of pleasure and pain, in terms of happiness and sorrow, in terms of peace and agitation, you know? And so once that is understood really in terms of Ishvara, in terms of Ishvara means in terms of the innate order of the creation, you know? We understand these rules in terms of the innate order of the creation, which would be the same as saying the innate order of Ishvara, which we call Dharma. The innate order of Ishvara, the whole manifestation of this creation, we call Dharma. And so we learn this Dharma in terms of, in all the different cultures of the world, in terms of the rules that have been passed down, warnings, what to do, what not to do. In fact, Swamiji calls the whole first portion of the Vedas, the Karmakanda that deal with all rituals and dharma, as kind of a manual for the world. It's our manual for how to make it in the world, how to survive the world, how to be in this world, how to relate to others, how to relate to ourselves, how to relate to our duties in such a way as to have the maximum, to get the maximum relative shanti, the maximum relative peace. It's going to be relative because you have to keep maintaining it. You have to keep, you know, following certain attitudes and certain dharma and certain understanding in order to keep the mind in that kind of protected space of dharma, right? Well, the whole first part of the Vedas is about that. The last part of the Vedas, the Vedanta, the Upanishads, is about somebody who says, is there any place to rest, you know, where I can just be free, just be free in my wholeness, free in my well-being? Is there such a thing? You know, that's what we call moksha, where I can say, I'm free of dharma and adharma. I'm free of having to do this maintenance work, you know, of having to maintain. I can always make a mistake. It's impossible to do everything perfectly. Mm-hmm. In fact, dharma adharma can become very complex, you know. like what we think may be really helping somebody can in fact be harmful because of our limited understanding of the situation. So it's highly complex. And so it's impossible to do all of this perfectly so that you're just reaping punya, 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 punya. without any of the, you know, little papas sneaking in there. You know? So very, very difficult. So now, so, but anyway, here Bhagavan is talking about, for the mumukshu, the one who wants liberation, an understanding of this karma yoga buddhi where you see the whole creation as Ishvara. You know, and all of the actions that you do really are not for any, not the primary result that you're seeking. The primary result that you're seeking doesn't have as much to do with the result of the action. When you're doing an action to gain a result from that action, but behind that and more important is that I'm doing this action with this Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Means I'm doing it with a recognition of Ishvara, and my primary goal is to gain knowledge of Bhagavan, to gain knowledge of myself. That's the primary goal. To gain that knowledge, I need a buddhi, I need a mind, right, which is not being caught by the... It's kind of like in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna says something like, you know, my mind is like a boat in the storm. It's just being tossed all over the place. You know? I want a mind that rests in you. I want a mind that rests in Ishvara. A mind that rests in that which isn't subject to being tossed. That's what I'm seeking. And so the Karma Yoga Buddhi gives me that relative shanti, because the reason I'm doing the actions really is for the sake of Dharma. For the sake of Ishvara, you know, for the sake of Ishvara in the form of Dharma, so that I can have the relative shanti through which I can gain this knowledge. Something like that. So here Krishna's going on about all of this, you know, worship me and you'll be liberated. That's kind of a cynical way to say it. So that, worship me, you'll be liberated. Don't worship me, you won't. So that's how the Purvapaksha takes it. He hears it like that. That Krishna is saying, worship me, think of me in everything that you do. You know, whether you're eating, whether you're doing a puja, whether you're giving gifts, doing charities, do it all just for my sake and you'll be liberated. And so the Purvapaksha says, well then Bhagavan has Raga Dvesha. Bhagavan himself has Raga Dvesha. You like these people who are always thinking of you and being nice to you. You like them. And the people who aren't thinking of you and just going about living their life, you don't like them. So you have likes and dislikes. So you're just a samsari. this is Shankara. He says, Raga Dvesha Van Tarhi Bhagavan. He says, Bhagavan then, Tarhi means then, is one who has Raga Dvesha. Raga Dvesha Van Tarhi Bhagavan. And yet that because, right, Bhaktan Anugranati, because he blesses the bhaktas, the devotees. He blesses the devotees and not the others. Because he says, you know, do these actions thinking of me and, you know, I will bless you. You'll be liberated. But he doesn't say that about the others. The others won't be liberated. So you like these people and you don't like the others. That's the Purvapaksha. Okay? Purvapaksha means the critic comes in with an objection. This is the objection. And so Krishna says, Samaha aham sarva bhuteshu. He says, I am samaha. I am exactly the same in all beings. Sarva bhuta means all beings. Samaha aham. Aham means I. I am the same, samaha, sarva bhuteshu. I am the same in all beings. Na me dvesha asti na priyaha. For me, there is no dvesha, there is no dislike, nor is there any priyaha. There are no favorites. There's no beloved, and there's no hated person. I'm the same. I'm exactly the same in all beings. There aren't any favorites, and there aren't any people that are less than, are dvesha, hated, disliked. Then he says, But then he says, but ye bhajantu tu mam bhaktya. He says, but those who worship me, bhajanti means worship me or seek me or who are devoted to me, tu means but. So ye bhajanti, those who seek me, worship mam, me, bhaktya, with devotion, with bhakti. He says, mayite, they are in me, and teshu cha api aham, and I am in them. That's the verse. Those who worship me, they are in me, and I am in them. So here, Shankara gives a really nice way of understanding this. He says it in his example in the Bhashya. He goes, if there's a nice fire, which is producing a lot of heat, a person who's far away from that fire doesn't feel any of the heat. The cold is not removed by that fire at all, right? Because it's too far away. And so the fire is not reaching it to get rid of the cold. Whereas for a person who's near, right, the fire is warming it, right? The fire is removing the cold. So like that, if Bhagavan, the Atma, the Self, is the Self in all beings, it's not that Bhagavan is only in you and not in you, or only a little bit in you and a lot in you, right? Because Ishwaran, the nature of the Atma, the nature of the Self, is one without a second. It doesn't have any parts. There's not one self over here and another self over here, or one self that's a little more self on this side and a little less self on this side. Right? Because from the standpoint of the Atma, in fact, there is no time and there's no space, because there's no duality in consciousness. Right? There's only one consciousness. There's only one being. There's only one conscious being. And that conscious being is the conscious being which lights up the whole creation and is the very me, the very self, in every being. And so, whether known or unknown, okay, whether known or unknown, like say, for instance, there's a samsari, a person who has ajnanam, who has self-ignorance, and a person who's ajnani. Both people, the ajnani, who has no self-knowledge, and the jnani that has self-knowledge, both say, I am. I exist. I am a conscious being. Their sense of self is exactly the same. For you also, as an ajnani, when you are an ajnani, you have no self-knowledge, and you cross over and you have self-knowledge, your sense of self before, during, and after your recognition, your self-recognition, is exactly the same. It's not like you gain self-knowledge and you become somebody else. It's not as though you gain self-knowledge and you gain it by gaining it by the mind traveling somewhere to discover a long-lost self, right? That isn't you. I know that should sound absurd. It's as though you gain self-knowledge, and in the gain of the self-knowledge, you have traveled to a self that you never met before, right? And now you know that self and have the experience of that self, an experience you've never had before. This is what people think. Let me tell you why people think this, because it's in a sense it's totally ridiculous, because we're talking about self-knowledge, yourself, knowledge of yourself. But in the world, in the world of our experience, when we gain knowledge, we're gaining knowledge, if it's not a memory, when we gain knowledge of something that was not previously known, we are gaining an experience that we have not previously had, right? And so, say for instance, I've never seen that painting before, and I walk into the room, and now I see that painting for the first time. There's the long-lost painting. Right? I have never seen that painting before. Now I am having the experience of the painting. And now everything that everybody has told me about the painting, I recognize. Because now I have the experience of the painting. I didn't have that experience before. before I came into direct contact with it. And so that's how we think about knowledge, about gaining knowledge, you know? And so, say, for instance, you'll think, here's this talk going on, this talk about Vedanta, this talk about the self. And so you can take it, well, the self is like this, and the self is like this, and the self is like that, and like that, and like that. It has all of these characteristics and qualities. And now I have to realize this self. I have to gain. And what do I mean by that? We don't say, you can say I have to realize it, but what do you mean? I have to gain an experience of it. I have to gain an experience of this self. Just like everybody told me about this wonderful painting. I really want to see it. I need to gain an experience of this wonderful painting. You know, so that all of the words then, well, oh, I know what they were talking about. There it is. Now, that's what we think. We're going to gain self-knowledge. We have to gain an experience of the self, an experience of the self, so that then all of these words that are being told about the self, kind of like as a praise or a description, you know, will then have something, some place to land. Right? So that is what's causing, you know, a huge problem, because in fact, the self that you are, that the Upanishads are describing, in fact, they won't say that they're describing it. They are describing you, but they're describing you in such a way as to make you recognize that the self that you take yourself to be right now, the me that you take yourself to be right now, as this body, mind, sense, I can say I take myself to be a conscious being, and then I say, and this conscious being that I am is this body, mind, sense organs. And you all say that. This conscious being that I am is this body, mind, sense organs. And this conscious being that I am is this body, mind, sense organs. And so the conscious being that you are is a bottom line. It is a given. It doesn't matter. You see, this conscious being that you take yourself to be, it can be a happy conscious being or a sad conscious being or an upset conscious being, depending upon whatever the condition of the mind is. Because you've totally identified the conscious being with whatever these conditions are. You can be, I am this conscious being who is young, who is middle-aged, who is old. I am this conscious being who is smart, who is stupid, who used to be smart and now is stupid. all of these things, we're identifying me with all of the experiences that I'm having. Right? But what is true, and we'll all admit to, even though we're saying, we realize we're identifying with all of the experiences that we're having, I am the one who's having these experiences. And we identify with the experiences, but we also say, I am the one who's having the experiences. And that one remains the same. I had this experience, I had this experience, I had this experience. I felt this way, I felt that way, I felt that way. I was young. I was a baby, you know. I was a teenager. I was in my 20s, I was in my 30s, etc. It's always me. The me is constant. And so now, when the student comes to the teacher and asks, who am I? They're talking about this me, right? That is the constant, the one abiding amidst all of my experiences. That's what we don't realize. It's this me that is here as me, as the very self, the I, present in every experience that I have. So that I'm the what we call the anuvritti. I'm the constant, the one who runs through every single experience. Now I would like to know, I approach a teacher, I realize I don't really know who I am. You know? I know that I am here, but I don't really know who I am. What am I? Who am I? And what am I in relationship to my experiences? Who am I in relationship to you and to you and to you? Who am I in relation to Ishvara? Am I finite? Do I die when the body dies? Am I the one that transmigrates? Am I one who becomes many different bodies? What am I? That is a different question. I'm not asking about the self experience, the me. You know, the me, I am here. I'm asking, what am I? This me that is here in reference to all of these experiences. So this makes gaining self-knowledge a little different than gaining knowledge of the painting. Because the me, self-experience me, is already here. The experience is already here. I am already here. But I don't know who I am in reference to all of the changing experiences. I don't know if I last. I don't know my relationship to you. And all of these things I don't know. But the experience of me is here. I am. I exist. It's the bottom line of my experience. And so knowledge is now going to be not the gain of an experience, like the gain of the painting. It is a recognition of my nature in reference to all of these things in this creation that I've taken myself to be. So I have to remove the ignorance aspect of my experience. You know, there's an aspect of my experience of which I'm ignorant of. Like, for instance, I know I exist, but I don't know that my existence is timeless. I know that I am, but I don't know that my being is without end, without change. That I don't know. But that I am, I do know. And the amness that I know is Brahman. It's not somebody else. It is Brahman. It's just that I take my amness, my being, and identify it with this body, mind, and sense organs. I don't recognize it as the free, I don't recognize its freedom, that it's not subject to change. That my amness and my consciousness are one and the same. I can't look at being, nor can I look at consciousness as an object. Consciousness and being go together. And this consciousness, I know that I'm a conscious being, you know, but, you know, what is the relationship of this knowledge or this consciousness to my ignorance, for instance? What is the relationship of consciousness to ignorance? What is the relationship of consciousness to this body, to these sense organs, to the mind? I don't know that. I know that I'm a conscious being, but it might be because I have a mind that I'm a conscious being. Maybe the mind makes me a conscious being, right? Without the mind, the consciousness will go. And maybe the mind is a byproduct of the physical body. And without the physical body, the mind will go. If the mind goes, the consciousness goes. So I know the consciousness. It's my indisputable experience that I'm a conscious being. But I have no idea, really. I can have beliefs, but I don't really know the relationship of my consciousness to your consciousness, or my consciousness to Ishwara's consciousness, if there is an Ishwara, or my consciousness to the body, mind, sense organs. So knowledge is not about the discovery of consciousness. It's about removing the things that have been superimposed on it, that the consciousness that I am belongs to the body, mind, sense organs, right? Or the consciousness that I am is something that's subject to coming and going, or the consciousness that I am is itself a knower, rather than the consciousness that illumines the mind, which is a knower, and the sense organs, which are a knower. These things I don't know, but I do know myself as consciousness. And so here, when Krishna says, you know, I am exactly the same. I am the same one in all beings. For me, there's no dvesha. Dvesha, there's no dvesha, there's no hatred, there's no dislike, things deserving of dislike. There's no priya, there's no beloveds, there's no hated people, there's no beloveds. There is just my own presence, which is the self of all beings. I am the one who is the same in all beings. There is nothing else the same in all beings except for the Satchit. The minds are all different, the vrittis are all different, the bodies are all different. You have your set of cells, you have your set of cells, you have your set of cells, you have your set of vrittis. Just even think, just try to imagine to have two twin vritti, two twin thoughts. Your thought and my thought at the same time, exactly the same. It's not possible. Even in this room, if you just think, it's such an interesting thing. In this room, just imagine what thought everybody is having in this room. What perception each one of us is having. We can never have the same perception. It's not possible, because you'd have to come in here and look out through my eyes. Right? And say if you came in here and lined yourself up in front of me and looked. Now, we're not having the same perception, because I'm just seeing the back of your head. And you're seeing this. There's no possibility, right, of having two same experiences. There are generic experiences, like experiences of happiness or experiences of happiness, of sadness, all of these things, but they're all nuanced. And they're all surrounded by a different, they are all taking place kind of within a different situation. And so it's just infinite diversity. But within that diversity, there's one who is the same in all beings. And that one who is the same in all beings is not hating, not liking, because there's no dvaita, there's no duality. It's that the conscious being that I am illumines whatever minds are there, whatever creation is there, the conscious being that I am illumines that whole thing. But it itself, when I say the word illumines, that's a difficult word. It's like consciousness is illumining, as though consciousness is the conscious being that you are, this me, is performing an act of illumining. As though it's doing something. You know, consciousness isn't doing anything. Your being isn't doing anything. You simply are. You simply are a conscious being. One of the great meditations to do, really, is to, when you're doing japa, say the repetition of a mantra, the Om Namah Shivaya, or whatever mantra you choose, you do that for a while until your mind settles down. And then you notice that mantra passing through, and then you can ask yourself, am I doing anything to illumine this mantra? What am I doing to make this mantra known? Am I performing an act of knowing the mantra? Right? The mantra rises and sets. Using a mantra is good because a mantra, really a mantra, stands for all thoughts. Whether it's associative thinking, whatever the vritti is, whatever the thought is, there's thought. We use the repetition of a thought like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, to totally get rid of the distraction and break the associative thinking, so I can actually have the space to recognize my own presence and its relationship to the rising and setting of the thought. So we do that with a mantra. So Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. Then you can ask yourself, as this mantra is occurring, is going, what am I doing to illumine it? Am I the conscious being, this me, my own presence? Am I doing anything? Am I knowing anything? It's a really good question. Am I knowing? Am I knowing the mantra? Am I performing an act of knowing the mantra, of illumining the mantra? And what you'll notice, if you've done the mantra for long enough to really get a little bit of space between yourself and the mantra, what you'll see is that actually I'm not doing anything. I simply am. I simply am the me, the self-evident conscious being that I am. I'm not performing any action whatsoever. Nor from my own standpoint am I really even aware of the mantra or not aware of it. The question is totally irrelevant. I simply am the conscious being in which the mantra is occurring. And the mantra itself, as it occurs, as any thought occurs, it is known from its own standpoint. Right? It as though reflects consciousness. It itself rises in consciousness, and so it enjoys consciousness as though. That's what we call mitya. It comes into consciousness, and so it is known. It's not that consciousness is known. Get rid of all of the vrittis. It is known. It is simply abiding me. Like right now, if you can notice it, your sense of self, it simply is this me that you're so identified with as you. You're identified with it as you because it is you. That's why. That's why when you just recognize your own presence, that very personal presence of me, the me that's sitting here in the room, the me that's sitting here listening, just the me, just your own sense of self, that self is not doing anything. It never does anything. It is always just simply abiding, always exactly the same. The mind is engaged in this and in that, in different things. The mind has different reactions and different feelings. Right? But the me, the self, that's illumining it, is not doing anything. It's not getting mad, or nor is it getting excited. It's not saying, oh, my beloved has come, or my enemy has come. Right? It's the one that illumines the mind that's saying those things. Right? The mind can have those kind of feelings, but not the self. Your self is always exactly the same. So here, and the self that you are is the self that Ishwara is. And so here, Krishna is saying, I am exactly the same in all beings. There, for me, there isn't somebody who's a favorite or somebody who's hated. I'm the very self that is there, untouched, you know, and uninvolved, udasina, totally uninvolved, really, and unaffected, asanga, totally unaffected by all of the things that are going on. I remain as that very whole, complete self that is true for every, true as the very self of everything in the creation, all beings, not just human beings, all beings, the self of all beings in the creation. And so for me, there's no dvesha and there's no priya. It's kind of like an example that we use. It's like the sun. The sun illumines whatever comes into its wake. Right? Whatever allows for the day, whatever is in the day, you know, as opposed to the night, whatever is in the day, is illumined by the sun. The sun doesn't decide to illumine its loved ones and not illumine, you know, its the ones that it doesn't like. It doesn't have this type of thinking. It doesn't think like that. It is luminosity, and everything is equally illumined. You know, there's nobody in the sun saying, I only like you and I don't like you. That doesn't belong to the sun. For the sun, it simply is what it is. And for yourself, the self, you simply are what you are. There's no engagement like that. So that self, Ishwara says, Krishna says, I am that self who is the same in all beings. And then he says, those people who bhajanti, who seek me, who know me, who worship me. Bhaj has a lot of meanings like that. Who seek me, who know me, who worship me. Those people... with bhakti, he said, those people are in me and I am in them. Why are they in me? They are in me because they see this as me. That's why it's not as though the ajnani is equally in me, right? But they see this as me, and so they are in me. And then he says, and I am in them. How can I be in them? In fact, I am in all beings, but I am in them from their standpoint. They're not there because they're ajnani. They recognize that this self, which I am, is the self which Ishwara is. And so this, it's such a beautiful thing. You know, we all, in some way, in all the myths of the world, we say, we seek union with God. All the religions of the world, you know, you want to meet God. You want to have a union with God. You want to have an identity with God. Here what it is that all of that, what that really amounts to in the end, is the recognition that the conscious being, the me, the I am, is Brahman, is Ishwara. That this very self that you are is Bhagavan. It's not like you're merging with Bhagavan, that you're having a union with Bhagavan. It's that the very conscious being that is you is the conscious being which illumines the whole creation, the one from whom the whole creation comes. So Ishwara is really Brahman, which with Maya, this whole manifest creation comes into manifestation, goes into resolution, comes into manification, goes in. Is that you? No, just turn it off. We like it. into manifestation, goes in, you know, that whole thing comes from one being, and that one being is me, Bhagavan says. That one being is me. And so who is going to recognize that? Who's going to recognize me as Ishwara? Only those who know me, right? If you don't know me, you're not going to see yourself in Ishwara and Ishwara as abiding in you. You can't do that because you think that you are Atma. The Atma that you are is this body, mind, sense organs walking around in a world which is other than you, right? And God is up there somewhere. So Ishwara is up there in some form. It's in heaven. Ishwara is up there in heaven or in Swargaloka, you know, or in Krishna's Vaikuntha, you know, that Bhagavan's living up there, and you're living down here in this world as a little jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, you know, trying to make a life for yourself and praying to Bhagavan up there in heaven to help you. Right? And so for such a person who has that drishti, who has that vision, then you can't say, you know, I am in you and you are in me. You don't have that vision. That's the truth for everybody, but it's not your truth. You haven't recognized it. And so it's for those who recognize me, who seek me with that bhakti, with that devotion. But devotion means, what they mean here by when we use the word bhakti, for a mumukshu, or for a person who's seeking liberation, it isn't just one of the things that you're doing. You know, I think I'll get liberated and I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this, as though they're all, you know, kind of equal. Like I can multi-process, I can multitask, you know. And so, you know, this is fun and this is interesting and this is interesting. That isn't the situation for a mumukshu, for somebody who really desires liberation. These things that we, for a mumukshu, these things that we do in the world and these desires that we fulfill in the world are one order of reality that does not compare with what we're really doing, what we are primarily about. You know, you may have a job, you know, you may be married, you may have children, you may be engaged in all types of work, a very, very busy person. That's fine. But that isn't primarily what's important to you. Primarily what's important to you is moksha, is knowledge, is self-knowledge, is Ishwara. That's what's of primary importance. When that's of primary importance, you're still a human being in the world with things to do, karma to live out. The proverb to karma, all of that is still there. But what is primary for you is moksha. And so then, if that is true, what happens to your... what is your attitude toward all of this? All of the day-to-day life that we have to go on living. It's the attitude is dharma, one of dharma. You know, let me live in this life, do what is to be done, you know, as a sadhana. It's all as a sadhana for Ishwara, for self-knowledge. So that my primary purpose is to do what is to be done so that I can have that shantavritti, which can allow me to gain this knowledge. I see the whole thing is Ishwara. And then everything takes place within that, like within that overarching vision. Everything else I do, you know, is something which is included and held by that. It's not to, this is a, something that really important in the whole kind of this world of spirituality. It's not about not doing these things. It's also not about rejecting them. Unless they're adharmic or they're bad for you. Like, say, if you drink too much or you're, you know, taking drugs or smoking cigarettes or stealing cars or something. You know, all of these things that are creating a lot of dukkha for you, really. These things are things that through discipline, as we'll see in the next verse, next time, through discipline you drop these things off, or you drop off behaviors that are causing pain. Right? So, but in terms of fulfilling your karma, you know, or fulfilling the desires of your life, it's not a statement on that. it's not saying you shouldn't love anybody. You shouldn't. It's not saying you shouldn't engage with anybody, or that you shouldn't enjoy living. It's not that at all. You're going to be a spiritual person, don't enjoy your life. Don't enjoy others. Don't love others. Don't engage with others. Ugh. What, you know, the Bhagavad Gita makes fun of this, actually. It makes fun of this attitude, you know. It's more to say how to be free in your life. How to be, you know, free in your relationships, in your work, in the life as it unfolds to you. It's not about rejecting the life. If you have to reject the life, then that becomes a real problem. Where are you going to draw the line? You know? Like, oops, you're causing me problems, go. You're causing me some problems, you better go too. This situation is causing me some problems, so we have to get rid of that one too. Where does it stop? What the whole Bhagavad Gita is, no. If that's how you feel, you just stay right there. You stay there until you don't feel that way. You stay right where you are until that situation, you know, you're free in that situation. You know? And I still remember, this wasn't too long ago. Maybe 5 years, 6 years ago, not very long ago. I was working, you know, at this, where I work at school at CIS. I like it there too. But there was a personality problem with one of the people there, you know? And I thought, I'm quitting. I'm gonna go. I just don't want to deal with it. It's not necessary. I don't need this. There are other things I'd rather do. And so I was telling Swamiji about this. He said, no, you have to stay there till you don't feel that way anymore. And then you can go. That's the last time he said that to me. There was others before then. That's not the only time. There's been others before that one.
But you got it.
I got it. Yeah, I got. Not that that won't come again, but I really understand that now. I think finally I've really, if there's something, it comes down to this, if there's something, you know, that's really hard for you in a situation, you have to look inside yourself to see, you know, what it is that you're doing to make it that way, you know. In what way are you involved, how are you involved in it that's making you miserable? You know? Once you figure that out, you know, then you can leave. Then you can leave. But don't ever leave in weakness. In this Bhagavad Gita, at the beginning, Arjuna was saying, I do not want to be in this war. I would rather go up to the Himalayas, you know, and become a sannyasi. I would much prefer that than having all of this wealth and all of this kingdom that's just going to be stained with the blood of, you know, my blood of my teachers. Some of them were on the other side. Blood of my teachers, blood of my family, you know. I don't want anything to do with this. I'm not going to fight. And he just plops himself down, you know. And then Krishna, you know, really lets him have it. He says, no, you have to. What will they all say about you? You're talking about, you know, he approaches it from different levels, but one of the things is, like, say you're having difficulty with this person, or this person is making your life miserable, and you just run away. That's what they'll say. Look at him.
Coward.
What a coward. Look at him. He's such a small person. He just run away. He can't face this battle. What a little peon. You know, and so Krishna talks to Arjuna this way. This is what they'll all be saying about you, you know? That you've just fled, that you're weak, you know? How can you be like that? This is your dharma. This is what you need to do. So it goes on and on and on. If you want to understand it, go into the chapter 1. And chapter 1 and then the first 11 verses of chapter 2, you know? And you'll see how he talks to him, you know? And so, and I've heard Swamiji talk like that too. And I understand it now. Because the more you give in to that type of weakness, the weaker you become. You know, you say, well, this situation's, you know, this person's too much for me, or this situation's too hard on me, I'm gonna go. So then you go, okay? And so now you're in a weakened condition. Okay, now the next situation comes up. Some difficult person, because, or difficult situation. Because haven't we all found that? You know, it's like you go from one difficult situation to the other with a few little nice moments in between. So now you're already in this weakened condition, so now you go to this other next situation. Same thing starts happening. And then what are you going to do? Oh, well. Does not work. It doesn't work at all. It doesn't work at all. You have to go inside, you know. You have to go inside of yourself and see. That's why the whole, as you'll say over and over, the whole, this world, your life, your prarabdha karma, this is your sadhana. This is your sadhana. If it is difficult, if there's some difficulty here, well, this is the lesson. This is where you need to grow, because there's a difficulty. You know, and if the difficulty is really hard, well, that's because finally you're ready for this hard one, you know. You have now risen. You see what I mean? You have matured. You've matured to a level now to be able to handle this whopper. And so Bhagawan gives it to you. You know? And the thing is, this is what's so interesting. It could be really a difficult situation for someone. And for another person, not difficult at all. Mm. Nothing. I mean, nothing. Mm. Not even something that they would think of as, that would even occur to them as being difficult. So it all depends on perspective, and it depends on desires and conditioning and all of these things. That's why you have to go inside and see what is actually going on there with me, you know? But why do we do that? It's because we're seeking something. We've recognized, we have mumukshutvam, we've recognized that in the end, the ananda or the wholeness or the fullness we seek has nothing to do with any of this. This cannot provide it. That's what a mumukshu has recognized. And in recognizing that, then these type of sadhanas, these type of understandings become meaningful. Otherwise, they're not meaningful. It's like, well, you know, in truth, there is really a lot of happiness to be had out here. But you're not being allowed to have it right now, that's all. But it really is out here to be had. But what about when you know that, no, it's not really out here to be had at all. It already is in here. It already is here. Right? It is already my very nature, my very swarupa. And so I am denying it to myself by my attitude. That's what a mumukshu understands, because you're gaining knowledge. Somebody who's studying the Bhagavad Gita is gaining self-knowledge and also all this karma yoga buddhi. Hmm. It's not like a karma yogi or somebody who's studying the Gita is not gaining self-knowledge. You're gaining self-knowledge. You're in the world and you're gaining self-knowledge. Right? And so gaining self-knowledge, living in the world, this world becomes your sadhana. It's like your laboratory, you know, for working out whatever the things are that are causing you problems in light of your knowledge. Does that make sense? Hope so. So, let's stop there. This next verse is really kind of a nice continuation where he says, you know, even the worst, even a really real person is really bad. Just a really, really bad person. You know, if they're a mumukshu seeking me, you should view them as a good person. So we'll see that. Why? Because they're seeking me and they'll become good. So he says, they're seeking me and they'll become good. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.